Die Groot Breakfast. Saam met Ruben en Jen. Weeksoggende 6 tot 9. Net hier op Groot FM 90.5.
En ons moet 'n bietjie hieroor praat, want dis nou 'n warm onderwerp op hierdie stadium.
Absoluut.
So storie en half. En ons gesels met Dr. Michael Mull, South Africa. He's a medical doctor and executive television producer, presenter, international speaker, business consultant and CEO of Truth TV. Sure, what a line. Dr. Michael Mull, good morning.
Good morning, Ruben. Hello, Jennifer. Good to chat to you guys this morning.
Morning.
I can't genoeg awesome om al hy goed te sê nie, Dr. Michael. It's a lot of stuff, eh?
Well, I tell you what, I lost my breath when you said Bitcoin. I'm like, oh, no.
Exactly.
Ruben.
Exactly.
And I heard Jennifer said the same thing. She was like, oh.
Dr. Michael, just before we start, you are probably, I said earlier, it's so hard for me to talk to somebody like you because you are such a professional presenter. Just give me one tip to be as professional as you, please.
Well, I would win an award. Hang on a second. You did win an award.
Come on. Come on. Come on. Yeah.
Oh, well played.
All right, your check is in the post. I just transferred the money. I just transferred Bitcoin over there.
Bitcoin. I was going to say, don't give me a check. Give me Bitcoin.
Yeah, Bitcoin gestuurd. Dr. Michael, let's start. Let's talk about this. I mean, the vaccines has been around for years now. So, yeah. Are they really the silver lining when it comes to COVID-19? Let's get that out of the way.
So, Ruben, you're right. I mean, they have been around for years, and people don't realize how many years. I mean, the first official vaccine, which was for smallpox, was developed in the 18th century. I mean, that's way back when. And in fact, anecdotally, these early immunization scientists from China would allegedly take smallpox scabs and crush them into powder and blow them up your nose to, you know, in an attempt to gain immunity. So basic principles, but they were, you know, they were on their way. But again, since then, it's not only been vaccine tech that's improved, but the health of the world. And vaccines really have had an impressive run of success. I mean, they've been able to control and in many cases, completely eliminate highly contagious and deadly diseases. I mean, I'm talking polio and measles and mumps and rubella. That, you know, we don't bother with those anymore because of vaccines. And while some diseases come and go, the more we learn about COVID, the more it becomes clear that it's going nowhere fast. I mean, a vaccine really has therefore become an almost exclusive solution, first to protect those obviously most at risk, but secondly, to create a situation of overall immunity. Wow. So that they really are the silver lining. I mean, we can get into how they work and get into that sort of detail, but you know, maybe save it for later.
So before we...
In fact, maybe let me say this, Jennifer, before,
yes.
Because people often say, so why not just get sick, you know, instead of get the vaccine. But the first time you get infected with the virus that causes COVID-19, it takes several days or weeks for your body to make and use all the germ-fighting tools you need to get over that infection. And then after the infection, your immune system remembers what it learned about how to protect the body against the disease in future. You know, it's a long process. But a vaccine does all of that without you needing to get the virus in the first place. Obviously, different vaccines work in different ways to offer protection. But with all types of vaccines, your body's left with a supply of memory cells, or these things we call T lymphocytes, that remember how to fight that specific virus in the future and provide you with immunity. And you do that without the risk of death, you know. So that's the bottom line. Sorry, Jennifer, I won't interrupt again, I promise.
That's absolutely fine. Because I do actually want to just bring it back a little bit before the vaccine. Because we just experienced, obviously, a horrible third wave in South Africa of COVID-19, especially in Gauteng. Can we expect a fourth wave?
So, I mean, Jennifer, based on current vaccination rates, what are we at the moment? I think 8.3% or 8% this morning. But, I mean, that and increasing levels of hesitancy, it's unlikely that we're going to avoid a fourth wave.
Wow.
I mean, predictions are that it's going to hit us during December holiday season. Can you believe it?
But, yeah, it's crazy.
And, you know, statistically, the waves of infection tend to peak around 6 months apart. And of course, future waves, and this is not only the fourth, but the fifth, the sixth, the seventh, are all going to be dependent on vaccination rollout, you know, how much vaccines we have, the uptake of those vaccines, and, of course, our human behavior, you know, social distancing, masking, and so forth.
We're going to get to all of that right after this.
Die Groot Breakfast met Ruben en Jen. Weeksoggende 6 tot 9. Net hier op Groot FM 90.5.
Ons gesels nou heerlik met Dr. Michael Mull. Om ons 'n bietjie meer te vertel van die COVID-19 inentings, dat ons 'n bietjie meer verstaan hoe hierdie storie werk. So, doctor, let's dive straight into the, some of the questions here. Somebody says, well, the question is, both the Pfizer and Johnson & Johnson vaccines are available in South Africa. So what exactly is the difference between the two?
Okay, so that's a great question, Ruben. I mean, let's kick off with Pfizer, and particularly Pfizer now in August became the first COVID-19 vaccine to receive full approval for people ages 16 and older from the FDA. That's this big administration in the States. So how it works, I mean, unlike vaccines that put a weakened or an inactivated disease germ into your body, and that's kind of what the older vaccines did, and as I said earlier, vaccine tech has also improved. The Pfizer mRNA vaccine delivers a tiny piece of genetic code from the SARS-CoV-2 virus to our cells, host cells in our bodies, essentially giving those cells instructions or blueprints, if you like, for making copies of spike proteins. Now, the spikes are those things you see sticking out of the coronavirus in all the pictures online and the cartoons and TV, etc. Now, the spikes do the work of penetrating or infecting your and my cells. And those proteins stimulate an immune response, which produces antibodies and develops memory cells that will recognize and respond if your body is infected with the actual virus. Okay, so that's the mRNA way of doing it. It's a piece of genetic code. If you look at the Johnson & Johnson virus, that's different. That's a carrier vaccine, which obviously uses a different approach than the mRNA vaccines, but they also instruct cells to make that SARS-CoV-2 spike protein. So what scientists do is they engineer a harmless virus, an adenovirus, which is really just a common virus that when it's not in, or, you know, when it's not inactivated, it can cause colds, bronchitis, other illnesses, that sort of stuff. And they use that as a shell to carry genetic code on the spike proteins to the cells, like a Trojan horse, if you like. And the shell and the code can't make you sick, but once the code is inside your cells, the cells then produce a spike protein to train your body's immune system, et cetera, which then creates the antibodies and the memory cells. So the same final outcome, but two different approaches. The Johnson & Johnson obviously is the original, and the Pfizer is a slightly newer tech.
So this might be a very tough question, but which is the best thing? And is there something like the best?
It's not a tough question. I get asked that question all the time. In fact, the question I get asked is, which vaccine should I take or choose? And my answer is the one that gets offered to you. Because remember, each vaccine has passed all the regulatory authorities' levels of efficacy. So nothing is going to get injected into your arm unless it's passed these stringent tests. So whether it's Pfizer, whether it's Johnson & Johnson, get that. I'm not going to comment on Sputnik. Don't ask me about that. Okay. But the two that we have in our country, man, whichever you get, you take.
Dr. Michael, I have to ask, because you just mentioned that the FDA has approved Pfizer, and the other vaccines are at this stage used, for example, being administered during emergencies. Does that mean they're not as safe, or do we not have enough information about them, or are they still going through testing? What does that mean if they're not approved, but the FDA has approved Pfizer?
So, Jen, great question. In a nutshell, they are all safe, but the FDA needs additional information on the other vaccines. So what people need to understand is not every vaccine is granted an emergency use authorization before full approval. Okay. All right. In other words, the FDA authorized emergency use of vaccines because the available data from the clinical trials to date showed that the vaccines were very effective in preventing COVID-19 and the risks of serious side effects were extremely low. But the FDA being the FDA and the CDC, that approval takes place when there's enough data to continue to demonstrate that these vaccines are safe and effective.
Okay.
And when the FDA has had that opportunity to review and approve the whole thing, it becomes fully approved. So Johnson & Johnson by the end of this year, I think, and obviously Pfizer this month.
Okay.
So I think the biggest thing is a lot of people is hesitant about the vaccine. So the question is, do they have the right to be, or should vaccines be compulsory for all?
So I'm going to give you a scientific response, not a personal response, because that's a very prickly question. I mean, is hesitancy justified? Now, there are a number of ways of approaching that. And I think, you see, hesitancy is based on what we know and what we believe. And I think social media has just made it really difficult to know what we believe and what we don't believe. So, I mean, hesitancy emerges from a series of beliefs, and the most important being skepticism about the collective benefits of vaccination. I mean, in South Africa, the most common reasons for hesitancy are worries about side effects, doubts about effectiveness, and the perception of their own low risk of disease. You know, it'll never happen to me. And obviously, the rapid development of COVID-19 has reinforced these concerns. How can a vaccine that's been developed so quickly be safe, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah.
Now, you need good science to counter those. And we're going to see a drop in hesitancy. At the moment, hesitancy in South Africa is around 21-22%, which people don't realize. I mean, that means almost 80% of South Africans are like, dude, we're going to get this vaccine as soon as we can. Mm. But there's 22% that say, now, our constitution protects those that are hesitant, and that's fine. You know, if you have a reason not to want that vaccine, that's your decision. The challenge or the problem with a constitution is that it starts to affect those around you. And if we get into, and we don't have time this morning, but there was a precedent case set some years ago around tuberculosis where an individual refused to take his TB treatment, but was infecting those around him. And the Constitution says you don't have to take in anything you don't want to, but the Constitution was overruled in that instance to say you're affecting your community with tuberculosis because you refuse treatment, that you must take treatment. And I think we may get to that point when it comes to COVID.
Yeah, and I think somebody made this statement earlier. One of the comments I saw on social media, somebody said that they're not going to take the vaccine because they've had COVID-19. They don't feel they have to take the vaccine. And then somebody else commented on that and said, yeah, but the reason why the virus is mutating is because people aren't taking the vaccine, and that's causing the mutation of the virus. Is that a correct statement?
It is, absolutely. I mean, you know, the risk of severe illness and death from COVID far outweighs any benefits of natural immunity. All right. So people are saying, I actually hope I get COVID just so I can recover and become immune. You're playing Russian roulette. You really, really are. So if you've had COVID and do you still need the vaccine? The short answer is yes. And the reason is because scientists don't know for how long you're protected from getting sick again. So although you may have short-term antibody protection after you've recovered, researchers are still unsure about how long the protection will last. What we do know is the vaccine protection gives us a certain amount of months, and that's been proved and shown time and time again. So, yes, even if you've had COVID, please do get the vaccine. And that vaccine is going to minimize the spread of the virus. I mean, one of the other challenges we have in our country is we have an immune-compromised country.
Yeah.
And as a result, we're getting, people are developing mutations because they don't have a fully functioning immune system, which is why South Africa might become a bit of a hotbed for, mutating viruses.
Yep.
So, again, the vaccine is going to prevent that.
And I think the problem with that is it also goes further than just South Africans being ill and another variant coming up. It also means economically we remain on red list for many countries. It affects tourism, again, a whole cycle where it affects our economy. Dr. Michael, why are there so many different vaccines worldwide?
And there are many, Jen. I think there's something like 200 vaccines worldwide, which is crazy. And that's not a bad thing. And maybe here's why I say that. In December now, so this is a couple of months ago, there were over 200 vaccine candidates for COVID-19. And of these, around 52 were in advanced human trials with a bunch of others, obviously, to follow.
Yes.
Now, typically, many vaccine candidates will be evaluated before any are found to be both safe and effective. So, for example, of all the vaccines that are studied in the lab and lab animals, only around 7 out of every 100 of those vaccine candidates will be considered good enough to move on to clinical trials in humans.
Wow.
And of the vaccines that do make it to clinical trials, just 1 in 5 are successful. So, I mean, that's why there's so many vaccines. And obviously having lots of different vaccines in development increases the chances that there'll be one or more successful vaccines that will be shown to be safe and efficacious for, you know, that intended population.
Mm.
So, yeah, we want more vaccines.
Awesome. Okay, so we're going to get to the rest of the questions right after this.
Die Groot Breakfast. Saam met Ruben en Jen, weeksoggende 6 tot 9, net hier op Groot FM 90.5.
En ons is selfs bietjie vanoggend met Dr. Michael Mol, spesifiek oor die inentings, wat ek weet baie mense het vra om die inentings. Dr. Michael, just before we took the break, I asked you about why there are so many different vaccines, and you said, well, it's actually quite good that there's so many different vaccines, and you took us through the process of like how many actually came out of the 200, it goes down to 7 and whatever. Is the international community working together quite closely to actually get the best vaccine?
Jen, they are, in a nutshell. It's, you know, a lot of anti-vaxxers are saying it's pharmaceutical companies that are making money, but really, they didn't develop the vaccine. Scientists developed the vaccine. And the beauty of what COVID has done is possibly for the first time in history, scientists have combined their work. Normally, scientists will hold their work close to their chest because that's their IP. That's what, you know, they're known for. But because of COVID, they're saying, listen, this is what we know. What do you know? And let's combine our thinking and come up with a solution. And as one global community, fight this virus. You know, we're at war with the virus. So absolutely. I mean, scientists are doing some amazing work to make sure we all have the best information and best knowledge to get the best vaccine.
Dr. Michael, some of the questions on the WhatsApp line. Somebody says here, my daughter is a healthcare worker. She's 25 years old. She got a Johnson & Johnson in February month, 2021. Does she need to go for the Pfizer now?
No, not yet. So in November, Johnson & Johnson, this is November last year, announced that it would launch a second phase 3 clinical trial study using 2 doses 2 months apart to see if that would improve or provide better protection. So I think for now, I wouldn't. There are some individuals who are doing it anyway just to be safe. Mm. That, again, I'm quite comfortable to say we don't know yet. And I'd rather say that than make some sort of statement that doesn't have any scientific backing behind it. So I like her. I had the Johnson & Johnson, a single dose. Had 2 days of severe tiredness, painful injection, but that's it. And, you know, nothing else since. And in fact, that's a Sonke trial. About 6 weeks ago, I spent some time with Professor Glenda Gray. Has been an amazing trial. I mean, of the 470,000 healthcare workers that got the vaccination, 99% are reporting no COVID. 1% that are reporting COVID, 9 out of 10 times, it's mild. So it's been phenomenal on a single Johnson & Johnson dose.
So there's some reports that we might have to look at a third booster shot eventually. Do you reckon the vaccine will become like a flu shot that we'll have to take annually?
Ruben, I think that's going to be the case. I think COVID is with us. I think it's going to be with us for a long time to come, much like the flu. And I think we're going to have to do this annual vaccination like we do with the flu jab. And by the way, why are we talking the flu jab? Because that's a simple yes, Ruben, I think you're right. But people also ask, should I have the flu jab this year? And look, I recommend the flu jab every year, but even so more this year. I mean, for two main reasons. First, that by having the flu jab, your risk of developing any severe complications is reduced if you do happen to get the flu. And that also means you won't be putting any strain on the healthcare system. Mm. But it also means if you do persist or present with severe complications, your doctor can more easily exclude flu as a possible factor. So that's a very important point. And then secondly, it lowers your risk of getting flu, which automatically lowers your immunity. And with a lower immunity, obviously more likely to pick up other infections, in this case, COVID. So I would say definitely get the flu jab this year. Just make sure it's not within 6 weeks of your COVID jab.
Ah,
absolutely. Okay. I have to ask, so we've established that the vaccine is safe. Is the vaccine safe for someone that has diabetes or someone that is going through cancer treatment, for example?
Absolutely. So again, I mean, I say yes, and we can leave it there, Jennifer, but the truth is patients with type 2 diabetes and type 1 diabetes have obviously got an increased vulnerability to severe illness from COVID-19 compared to people obviously without diabetes. So primary prevention is obviously the mainstay to prevent the risk associated with COVID-19. And pretty much, in fact, in the United States, people with living diabetes are a priority group for vaccination. Oh, so wow. Yes, if you've got diabetes, you must be getting vaccinated. The American Society of Clinical Oncology, so that's the Cancer Association in the States, their recommendations are patients with cancer may be offered the COVID vaccine, provided there are no contraindications to any elements of the vaccine. We can maybe talk to that a bit later. That's basically an allergic reaction to certain elements of the vaccine. But patients with cancer can get it. Patients receiving chemotherapy can be given the vaccination, and cancer survivors can be given the COVID vaccine. So absolutely, COVID diabetes, get the vaccine.
Okay, but who cannot get the vaccine then?
So the only people that we recommend don't get the vaccine are those that have an allergic reaction or possibly have had an allergic reaction to a previous dose or to components of the vaccine. And that's the case with, you know, other vaccines as well. And I mean, one of the components that has caused some reaction is something called polyethylene glycol. Now, if you don't know what that is, then you are unlikely allergic to that. If you do, you possibly have an allergy, you know, and that polyethylene glycol is in Pfizer and the Moderna vaccine. And there's something called polysorbate 80, which is in the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Again, if you know that and you kind of go, oh no, I'm allergic to polysorbate 80, then, you know, I'd be careful. And I'd go speak to an allergologist, a person who specializes in allergies, because there might be a way for you to get the vaccine anyway. But people aren't allergic to the vaccine, just to the elements in a vaccine.
That makes sense. What are some of the side effects of the vaccine? Now, I know not everyone will experience the side effects, but what are some of the general side effects?
Chills, headache, pain, tiredness, redness, swelling at your injection site. I mean, they're all mild side effects, all resolved within a day or two, Jennifer. You know, a bit of rest, hydration. I mean, I sound like a typical doctor, just rest and drink more and, you know, and some pain medication. And that's really all you need to manage your side effects with. There, on rare occasions, the vaccine has triggered an allergic reaction, which is what we just talked about. Mm. But you treat that with a bit of adrenaline, you know, these EpiPens. And that's why, by the way, after you've had your vaccine, you're required to wait around for 15 minutes just to see if you are going to get that allergic reaction.
And can I expect about a gigabyte download of the 5G, more or less, Dr. Mike? No, I'm just kidding. Let me just go. Okay, I was going to get off.
You know, COVID is in every single country, even where they don't have 5G. Okay. I mean, that just blows that theory right out.
Okay, all right. So they'll probably have 3G then. But anyway, 8:43. Okay, 8:43. Ons tyd hardloop uit, so ons moet nog gesels met Dr. Michael Moll om ons 'n bietjie meer in te lig rondom die inspuitings, die verskillende inspuitings, die nadele, die neeweffekte en allerlei sulke goeders. So dis verder, ons al baie geleer. Ek het al geweldig baie geleer. Ek kan nog steeds nie onthou wat daai woord was nie, maar dan weet ek is veilig om dit te vat.
Dat jy nie allergies nie.
It's very high terms. I'm just known as Dr. Feelgood, but I haven't studied that far yet. Dr. Michael, I think the big question is, do I have a better chance of surviving COVID if I have the vaccine? And I suppose what goes with that, and what are the percentages of the stats? What are they saying currently?
So, by the way, I wish I was called Dr. Feelgood. I mean, that's a great title to have. My word. Very cool. Ruben, very briefly, and I don't know stats for you on that percentage, but probably 3 or 4 Sundays ago, there was an article in, I think it was the Sunday Times, could be mistaken, but it was one of our UCT COVID wards here in Cape Town, where the head of that ward was simply saying, none of the patients in my ward are vaccinated. In other words, every single patient in the COVID ward was an unvaccinated patient. And that alone just says something. I mean, vaccines don't prevent you from getting COVID, but they prevent you from getting severe disease and from dying from the disease. And so, yes, do I have a better chance of surviving COVID-19 if I have had the vaccine? Absolutely.
I think that's quite an important point that I think a lot of people miss, is that the vaccine does not prevent you from getting it. It just prevents you from maybe dying from COVID.
Getting a severe version.
Yes, because a lot of people will go, yeah, but look at England, for example. Most of the adult population has been vaccinated, yet their numbers are climbing. Where they've also opened up, they're like not really forced to wear masks outside anymore. They're holding like big sports events. So they are busy testing those things. So I think also just to keep that in mind. My other question is...
Actually, Jennifer, can I comment on that quickly?
Please.
Because you make such an important point. If you, I was going to say Google Johns Hopkins graphs. No one's going to do that, obviously. but there's a wonderful graph that Johns Hopkins brought out that showed England's 3 waves, and they were vaccinated before their 3rd wave. And the infection rates in the 1st and 2nd wave were sort of paralleled or compared to their death rates were identical. And then in the 3rd wave, they had almost 0 death rate because they were vaccinated. So yes, people still get infected, but the death rate came to, you know, almost nothing compared to the previous 2 waves. Hmm.
Dr. Michael, a question on the WhatsApp line. Is it safe if I've previously had a blood clot? And what vaccine would be the best then?
So I would certainly go and speak to a specialist or your GP if you have had a blood clot and you're concerned. Look, the again, this is a step that's been bandied about. I still need to get the research on this, but the chances of developing a blood clot with COVID is something like 10 times greater than developing it with a vaccine. Mm. But again, that doesn't have any science to back it. That's just some of the kind of verbiage that's been bandied about. So if you are at risk, by all means, go and see a specialist and get your vaccine with that particular individual.
We keep, yes.
But again, the risks are just, if you look at the statistical risks of a blood clot, it's almost non-existent.
Okay.
We keep hearing about herd immunity and how we should work towards that. What is herd immunity?
So this is a tricky question, Jen. I mean, herd immunity is, well, let's just say this, and let me preface it with this. A number of health experts now believe we're not going to reach herd immunity.
Oh, wow.
And there are certain implications related to that, because herd immunity is generally achievable only with high vaccination rates. And a lot of scientists initially thought that once people started being immunized en masse, you know, we get to that 60-70% of the population, herd immunity would permit society to return to normal.
Yes.
That's no longer the case. We don't think like that anymore. Okay. So, I mean, and the herd immunity threshold, by the way, is also determined by factors beyond just vaccination. It's seasonal effects, the, you know, time spent indoors, the behavioral factors about whether you mask up and wash your hands, social distance, all that sort of stuff. But the reasons herd immunity is unlikely is vaccines are very effective at preventing symptomatic disease, but it remains unclear whether they protect people from becoming infected or from spreading the virus to others.
Oh,
now, again, there was some controversy in the States that was saying if you're vaccinated, you don't have to wear a mask. We certainly didn't do that in our country. We said, please keep masking up, even if you have been vaccinated, because we don't know for sure.
Hmm.
All right. Vaccine rollout slow, globally, and even all that sort of stuff. So just to kind of maybe sum up what we're saying there, that the end point of the pandemic is increasingly looking unlikely, with a shift away from path to herd immunity, and now we're looking at a path to normality. In other words, a more realistic endpoint might arrive when herd immunity is not achieved, but when COVID-19 can be managed as an endemic disease, as you said, Ruben, much like the seasonal flu. So that's kind of where we're going. We're going to normality rather than to herd immunity.
Hmm. Dr. Michael, thank you so much. Our time is running out, but before we let you go, I just want to address the big horse in the room. Tell us about ivermectin.
Okay, so you're pulling no punches, are you? So I need to kind of retract something I said earlier, not in this particular kind of interview, but earlier in this year. I mean, maybe just a little brief reminder of what ivermectin. Ivermectin was developed in the 1970s as an anti-parasitic drug, okay? And it's been a bit controversial because it was exclusively used to control parasites amongst animals, livestock. But lab studies have shown that it's also a powerful antiviral and anti-inflammatory product, which makes it this likely candidate for treating COVID-19. And over the past few months, there have been several studies published in peer-reviewed journals, which is important, which is, you know, that's a must for scientific credibility, to support the use of ivermectin as a treatment for COVID-19. And in fact, I think way back in March, they had this whole meta-analysis that showed that it really was effective. Something like 80% of patients showed improvement with early ivermectin treatment, while 50% showed sort of late-stage treatment. However, so that's what we went out with. Guys, if you've got ivermectin access to it, you should use it. But more recently, they've been shown that there's been a little bit of a mixing of data and a meddling of results. In other words, not accurate representation of those results. And so there's been a bit of a pullback on ivermectin to say, look, it's probably not going to do any harm, but it certainly isn't the be all and end all as far as a cure is concerned. And what you must not do is think, if I can take ivermectin, I don't have to vaccinate, because that doesn't make any sense at all. And that is wrong.
Wow, that's really, really interesting. Dr. Michael, we really appreciate you taking some time just to speak to us about some of the most prominent questions out there at this stage. And I think you've made some really good points that, yes, there are general things you don't know as an individual how you're going to react if you do get COVID. So please, you know, if you want to get the vaccine, it's no use taking the risk to go, I'll just see, you know, whether or not I survive or come off lightly if I do get it. And we also don't know if you get how you're going to react if you do get the vaccine. vaccine if you are allergic to anything like that. But generally, you know, it was so insightful speaking to you just to hear about the safety concerns about it and how long the testing process is before you actually go, here we go, here's a vaccine for the human race. It's not just something that gets made like in a couple of months. So I think I feel, you know, safer and more relaxed after speaking to you. So I really just want to say thank you so much for taking some time to speak to us this morning.
Jennifer, absolute pleasure. When I was in med school, we had this sort of question that we often asked ourselves, would I recommend this or would I give this to my grandmother? It was like this throwaway line of, you know, we're talking about a certain type of treatment. Would you give it to your grandmother? And maybe to answer that, I've had the vaccine. My wife's had the vaccine. My son, a med student, has had the vaccine. My daughter just turned 18, is also registered for the vaccine. So if anything, and it's again, this is my decision, but yes, I would give this to my grandmother and my mother.
Awesome.
So go right ahead.
Dr. Michael, thank you so much. At least I've got proper 5G signal now. And if I use ivermectin, I'm going to have proper horsepower. So that's me sorted for the rest of this
year. Says the feel-good doctor.
Hey, Dr. Michael Moore. Thank you so much,
Doc.
Thank you. Absolute treat, guys. Have a wonderful week.
You
bye-bye.
Too. Thanks. Bye.
Die Groot Breakfast. Saam met Ruben en Jen, weeksoggende 6 tot 9, net hier op Groot FM 90.5.